Hello, and welcome back to Affirmative Action. I'm your host, Antoinette Grajeda. Attacks against Asian Americans are on the rise in the United States. The Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, analyzed hate crimes in 16 of the country's largest cities and found hate crimes targeting Asians increased by nearly 150% in 2020. An incident that's gained national attention is a series of shootings at Atlanta area spas in March, where 6 of the 8 people killed were Asian women. So today we're speaking with a group of Arkansans who've taken action in response to increased attacks against Asian Americans. Activist Susie Reese has created a Facebook group for Asian American Arkansans called ArkAsians, along with Joshua Ong Price, the president and co-founder of the Asian American Pacific Islander Democratic Caucus of Arkansas. Following the Atlanta shootings, Joshua hosted a Stop Asian Hate virtual town hall. Bentonville City Councilwoman Gayatri Agnew and a friend partnered to host a vigil outside of the Momentary, a contemporary arts venue in Northwest Arkansas. Agnew says they organized the event for two reasons.
One was a sense of racial solidarity and allyship, specifically with the Asian community, but certainly just as a general statement of not wanting to see people othered, not wanting to see people told that a community like Northwest Arkansas is a community that is for white people. And so we wanted to make sure that in holding a vigil, we sent that message out, that there are a lot of people here, white, black, brown, et cetera, stand in solidarity with the Asian community. And then the second thing was just to send out a message of belonging. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the art installation, but there is an art installation at the Momentary that lights up at night and it reads, "You belong here." And on that particular night, we had, the Momentary. So actually the quick backstory is the art installation has a letter that's out. And so it didn't light up. And they were originally, we had asked if we could do the vigil beneath the installation. And they were like, "Gosh, we're so sorry. The installation actually isn't lit right now." And both of us were like, "Well, it's not irony, it's symbolism," right? And so we actually played into that and acknowledged that that particular installation that night wasn't lit because not everyone does feel like they belong. And so the vigil was really, it was really about emphasizing that sense of allyship and solidarity and taking a physical stand, a physical presence in the green in front of the Momentary to just acknowledge that everyone should feel a sense of belonging in the community where they live.
For me, it started really a year ago because, you know, I've not seen a lot of commentary or even acknowledgement from mainstream media about what has been happening. And so, you know, I'm in very involved in a lot of Asian social media platforms that are focused on groups. I'm half Korean, so I tend to fall into HAPA groups that are for half Asians. We have a very unique perspective. Mm-hmm. Which is typically different than those who are of full Asian descent. And so, you know, I've been following all of these incidents that have been happening, and they've just continuously seem as though it's increased. And so, you know, every few weeks last year, I would post something and share that this is what's happening. And so people would reach out. I had one woman who messaged me and said, you know, "I went to the store this weekend with my daughter. And as we were walking in, there was an Asian woman and I believe her daughter walking in at the same time. And we smiled at them and they just seemed so relieved. And I needed to tell you that because I needed you to know that what you're saying is not, it's true and it's really happening. And I saw this for myself. It was very obvious." And then other people would reach out and say, "I can't believe this is happening." And unfortunately, I feel like, and I don't know how the others feel, but in Arkansas, we are separated geographically. We don't have, we can't go to Koreatown. We can't go to, you know, our communities like people do in New York or in LA. And so the fact that our numbers are smaller, it's even more pronounced here because we just don't have those spaces physically that we can go to. And so many of the people that I'm friends with from within Arkansas are not of Asian descent. And to share that, it felt important because I kept telling myself, how else are they going to know? This mm-hmm. isn't happening in the mainstream media. No one's talking about it. And so for a year, I've been occasionally sharing things. And I kept thinking, you know, I know my algorithms and I can't just share negative stuff or everyone's going to unfollow me. And I just, you know, and it was, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, okay, I'll share something important and then something funny. And then, you know, and you play it out. And then what happened in Atlanta, I was so angry and I was just not just with what happened, but that I'm having to play this game and not explain how infuriating it is that we are not being heard. We're not even being highlighted that this is happening to us. And here I am, I have to share something once every 3 to 5 weeks so that people don't unfollow me. And so I for like a week after Atlanta, every day, all day long, I just shared about things that were happening. People unfriended me. People were very, very rude, to say the least. Many disrespectful, hurtful, just racist things said to me. And it was just, I knew that was what would happen a year ago. I knew that if I shared too much, people will tune me out. But that is so unfair because, you know, we need people to be aware of this. And how else are they going to be aware if we don't tell them, because they're not getting it from anywhere else? So for me, it was just feeling as though we've been boxed in so many different ways. And I'm tired of it, to be honest.
Yeah, I totally agree with Susie. And to kind of piggyback off that, I mean, I've been tracking this since last year, you know, when our former President Trump was referring to it as the China virus and the Wuhan flu and the Kung flu, I knew that rhetoric was so dangerous. My background is in public relations and marketing. So I was like, oh goodness, here's the branding campaign that's coming out pointing the finger at a specific group. And I knew that as the virus, the pandemic continued to, you know, just drag on, you know, people reach a breaking point. People are at the end of their rope. They're out of work, maybe been out of work for months, if not a year, having difficulty paying bills and sustaining their family. And hey, here's a group we can blame. Here's a group we can blame. Our elected officials are saying it's the China virus, it's the Wuhan flu, it's the Kung flu. And, you know, unfortunately, in the United States, and especially in the South, like Susie said, with us being such a small community, people don't know the difference between Chinese, Japanese, Korean, you know, Indonesian. I mean, oh, you're Asian, you're just a big block of Asians, right? So, I actually had a friend and a colleague here in Arkansas that last year during the summer, he was at a Walmart in Saline County, and was spat on and told to go back where he came from and take your Kung flu with you. And he left. I mean, he left the store. He was genuinely afraid. And, you know, the fact that things like that are happening is just ridiculous. So when there was instances, you know, in larger cities of elderly Asian Americans being pushed down or shoved or attacked, I felt like it was a matter of time before something happened that was a little bit bigger. And I know we talked in the community, we weren't surprised, sadly, we weren't surprised. And when this happened in Atlanta, I'm going to be very candid. I was just very, very sickened. The rhetoric that came out of that was, you know, oh, these are sex workers, so it doesn't matter. Or I had a sex addiction, I couldn't help myself. It's not a hate crime. You know, it didn't matter if they were Asian women. It's just, I had a sex addiction. I had a bad day. I was just trying to remove temptation. And I think that's just such a cop-out. I was very disappointed in the police force. I was very disappointed in the media. You know, and I sit on the media here very blatantly. I said, this is a hate crime and a sex crime. Doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both. At the end of the day, these were Asian women who were targeted for being Asian women. And it really disgusted me. And to be honest, it kind of triggered me. Because I mean, obviously I have an Asian mother, I have an Asian sister, and I got to talking with them and to hear their stories of the types of objectification and fetishization that was happening to them on almost a daily basis, that they just kind of swept under the rug. This is just normal. And I was like, that's just not acceptable. That's not normal. And when you don't, you don't know what's happening and it's not being called out and it's not being put in the media. It just continues to happen and it just builds and builds and builds. And that line in the sand gets pushed further and further where folks feel like they can do things like what happened in Atlanta. So it was just very, very shocking and upsetting to me. I had an incident in high school where I was asked by some classmates if my mother was a prostitute. No, just flat out. They said, is your mom a prostitute from the Philippines who got pregnant by an American soldier? And when I saw what happened in Atlanta, it's almost like that's the first thing that popped into my mind. This is how we view Asian American women, as some type of sex object, as some kind of toy that can be used and abused and just thrown away and doesn't matter. And I was really, really upset about it. I really was. And that's why I knew I had to speak out and say something.
So the shootings in Atlanta have been a catalyst for a lot of things. And there's been the Stop AAPI Hate movement or initiative, I guess. And so that was just a very prominent moment that got national attention. But a few weeks later, we got a report on local news about an incident in Hot Springs with a Bentonville fire captain who since resigned, who had attacked an Asian man there. And when I looked it up, even though we were just hearing about it because the report had been released, it actually happened a few days prior to the Atlanta shootings. Was that surprising at all to know that something like that had happened here in Arkansas before this major event had happened? And along those lines, I'm curious, for those of you who've grown up in the state or maybe lived here a number of years, what has your experience been like living here? Because as Susie mentioned, you don't have, because Asians are such a small portion of the population as a whole, you don't necessarily have some of those community spaces that you might have in a larger city. So, what has your experience as an Asian American in Arkansas been like? And were you surprised that this incident in Hot Springs had taken place prior to the Atlanta shootings?
I'm not sure you want the real answer.
So, I do. I do want the real answer. I do. This is a safe space and this is where we want to be honest. And I genuinely do want the answer.
I think that it's so easy to say that over my entire life that all of these bad things have happened and there are no good people. But there are, and we can't, we can't generalize either way. I lived in Hot Springs for 12 years and I love that community. I was heavily involved throughout the community in every way, worked with law enforcement, worked with fire departments, everyone. And I never felt ostracized or othered in those spaces, but at the same time, I worked very hard to establish myself as someone, as a part of that community. And so I felt welcomed in. Last year, after all of the rhetoric started, I know that there was a girl in Malvern had a similar situation to Josh's friend. She was coming out of Walmart, and as she was walking out, someone drove by, threw their drink at her, called her a racial slur, told her to go back to her country. And that was very early on. I want to say maybe even April of last year. And so we had mutual friends and I was seeing what was happening. And I had already been to the store a couple times and I had always been with someone. I just happened to be with a friend. And at two different times, my friend looked at me and said, "You don't need to go anywhere by yourself right now because of how people are looking at you." I mean, when this is all you see our eyes. And in my head, my glasses shift colors in the sun. So when I'm out in the day, that's the first thought I have is they can't tell what my eyes look like. That's my first thought every time. And I shouldn't have to think that. Over my life, I've had strange men walk up to me and ask me very explicit questions about my sexual organs and how they are made. I've had complete strangers come up into my face and say, "You look like you're foreign. Where are you from?" I've had lots of men make very inappropriate comments, touch me, do all kinds of things, talk about, how Asian women are in bed, lots of things like that. So I can completely attest to what Josh is saying. And part of that is because of the history of how Asian women have been treated and the fact that Chinese women explicitly were considered to have been prostitutes. And you had to essentially prove that you weren't going to prostitute, you had never prostituted, and that if you were coming into America, you would have nothing to do with that. But how do you prove something that hasn't yet happened or won't happen? You can't really do that. So, you know, when it came down to it, Asian Americans, we had for every 1,000 men back in 1800s or so, late 1800s, there were 76 Asian women. Because they knew that if they kept the women out, that how are we going to have children and how are our numbers going to grow? So I believe that that's part of what we're seeing now. And what's happened to me is this mentality of, oh, you know, they're prostitutes, and, you know, we can treat them as such because that's what we think and that's what we know.
Well, I'll say the incident in Hot Springs didn't surprise me, sadly enough, just because I had heard an incident that had happened with my friend in Saline County. So I wasn't too surprised. I was actually pleasantly surprised that the media did reach out. And I think it was just maybe the timing with what had happened with Atlanta and the fact that it was a fire captain from Bentonville. And I'm sure Guy will talk about that here in a minute. But it made me wonder if this wasn't a fire captain, someone that was in a position of authority, would it have got the attention that it did, or would it have been swept under the rug? And I was able to actually FOIA'd and heard the 911 calls. Gayatri, you may have as well. And it was actually reported by a third party. It wasn't even the victim of the crime that reported it. It was a third party that witnessed it and reported it, witnessed it happening, which, you know, was a little bit more condemning to the assailant. But I mean, even after I spoke out about it, I had people send me Facebook messages saying, you know, how dare you condemn this man? Maybe the Asian guy started it. You weren't there. And I'm like, I was like, well, you weren't there either, but I've read the police report and seen the police body cam. So, which you are welcome to FOIA and you can look at that too. But they said, no, that's okay. They didn't want to see it. But, you know, it was immediately defending the assailant and blaming the victim. No, the victim must've done something. So I agree with Susie. I feel like growing up in Arkansas, I was born and raised in Arkansas. I got a Southern accent I can turn off and on just like this. But I feel like growing up in rural Southwest Arkansas, I grew up in Pike County, D-Lite area, D-Lite. I was more of an oddity or a curiosity than anything else. I felt like people were generally friendly, maybe stuck their foot in their mouth a few times, but nothing that was blatantly hateful. But then again, when you have rhetoric coming from leaders and elected officials blaming a certain group, and then you have certain people that may have that racism just bubbling right under the surface, that's all the push it needs. You know, that's all the push that it takes to take that racism and that bigotry and turn it into a hate crime, especially if there's frustration and anger and that's been building up about their situation. Now, here's someone I could blame. You know, I never liked Asians anyway, and now I'm being told that they're to blame for this coronavirus, and that's why I lost my job, and that's why I can't put food on the table, so I'm going to go pick on them. And it's just really unfortunate, because at the end of the day, this is a global pandemic. You know, it's affecting everyone in the whole world. We're all in this together. No one is, you know, has not been touched by this pandemic in some way. And at a time we should be bonding together and trying to work together to get through it, we're pointing fingers at one another. So it to me, it was very unfortunate this happened. I'm glad I was able to, you know, bring some light to it, that the media reached out to me to speak on it, just because of what had been, you know, we had just had our town hall, and then this happened literally the next week. So it was very fresh on people's minds and very timely. So I'm glad it did get some attention on our Asian town hall. I think you saw, Antoinette, we had Mr. Wade Marshall, the president of the Arkansas Professional Firefighters Association, who was there, and he spoke about his thoughts on it, was very supportive of the Asian community as well. Actually his mother's best friend, I believe, was Japanese, and he grew up in her house pretty much. So he was very, very much a fan of Asian culture. I wasn't surprised. I mean, I wasn't super surprised to hear that it happened in Arkansas, but it was one of those things that it's like, you hate to hear it happen, but you're also not surprised. I mean, it was almost like akin to, you know, if you heard of, I don't know, sexual harassment in the workplace, like you don't want to hear it happening, but it's not super uncommon, right? So it is sad that it happened on our doorstep here in Arkansas, but I am thankful that this leads into you too, Gayatri, that our elected officials and our leaders seem like they really did step up in this instance and really address it and take it seriously.
I will say I was shocked. I was shocked and I was really saddened by the incident. The reason I was shocked is not that an incident of racial violence had potentially occurred or occurred, to Josh's point. We've all seen the body cam, so there's not a lot of question whether it happened or not. But what really shocked me and saddened me is that it was an incident that occurred involving a leader in the city that I serve on our council for. And you know, I think that without a doubt, public servants at every level do need to be held to a higher standard. That doesn't mean it would be okay for anyone to do this. But I think in part to Josh's point, you had sort of, you had a heightened level of national attention on these issues. You have a heightened level of statewide attention on these issues as a result of the debate that's underway in Little Rock about hate crimes legislation. And then you have this incident. What worries me or makes me anxious about this is I think this incident easily could have gone unnoticed in very recent times at a different moment in time. And so I think, you know, for me, what this incident really validated, and we all know this to Josh's point, is racism is everywhere and no community is immune to having an incident occur that's a racially motivated incident. Which is part of why I feel so strongly about having hate crimes legislation, because violence is not violence. Violence is violence and racially motivated violence. It hits at a deeper level. You know, and Josh was talking about his mother or his sister. My father is an immigrant from India, and I can name a lot of incidents, some that involved law enforcement in positions of power and authority where my father was treated in ways that, you know, I just don't know at the time if I realized were as bad as they were, but reflecting on them and looking back on them, it just tightens my stomach to think about how he was spoken to or how he was treated or how much he was othered as a result of his accent, as a result of his skin tone, as a result of his background. And so, you know, I just, to know that it just could have been any one of our family members, it's not empathy, it's emotion. It's immediate emotion. It's my emotional reaction to knowing that it could have been a family member of mine that was attacked. It wasn't, but I have a different level of empathy than someone who might look at that incident and go, well, I'm sure he provoked him, right? Like those are totally different ways to react. And the level of, I don't know, you know, just to not recognize that, you know, two men on the street getting in a fight is very different than one man being violently attacked by another man because of his racial background. Those are apples to oranges kind of incidents. And when our laws in Arkansas don't acknowledge them as different incidents, we are complicit in that hate. There's just that for me, there's not another way to put those puzzle pieces together. And so, you know, I think the first step around all of this is acknowledgement. So I'm not by any measure happy the incident occurred, but I am happy the incident was acknowledged and reported and to some extent addressed. You know, the resignation that occurred by the fire captain in Bentonville, I think was a right step. I think our city, our community still has more work to do, as to all of us, but our city leaders were really quick to say that we don't have and will not tolerate hate and violence and discrimination in our community. And I don't want that to feel like a big deal, but it kind of feels like a big deal to pause and say, we don't tolerate that kind of behavior.
I don't see how that could have been interpreted as anything but a hate crime, what happened in Hot Springs. You know, the victim in his own words said that the assailant said to him, I'm going to kill you and your type of people. You know, it's not just, hey, dude, get out of my way. And then we got in a scuffle. He literally said, you know, you're in America, right? I'm going to kill you and your type of people. So he was obviously directing this violence and this threatening language towards a certain type of people. So, you know, that's what we would like to see protected in Arkansas under a comprehensive hate crimes bill. And I know we did pass, we've got one that's kind of going through right now, but whether that's comprehensive enough that's another debate. But, you know, I just don't think like anyone should feel unsafe in our state. You know, we all have the right to feel safe and protected. Sorry, go ahead, Gayatri.
No, that's the other thing I was going to comment on, though, is this idea of safety. And when you feel unsafe, what do you do? Hopefully, if you trust your local law enforcement, you call 911. Mm-hmm. And so for me, what was really unsettling in the context of this incident is the idea that potentially on the other end of the line is someone who's not going to treat everyone equally or fairly. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes it that much more urgent and important for municipal authorities, for a city like Bentonville, to be really clear about where we stand on an issue like that. And it's not about the investigation against a specific fire captain. It's not about the outcome of that criminal case. It's actually not about that at all. But that incident creates an opportunity to emphatically vocalize the opposition to hate, to violence, to discrimination, and to say we're a city and a community that stands for tolerance and inclusion, right? Like, and again, you wish that didn't have to be said, or you wish that it goes unsaid. But what I've really realized in this last year, particularly, you know, starting off with George Floyd's murder and the way that people reacted to that, and then coming on to these incidents in Atlanta, is, you know, if you are silent during this time, that silence unto itself is an action. And I think that we like to believe that silence is more of a, well, you know, I assumed everyone knew that I didn't support racial violence, but unfortunately, silence is all but an endorsement of that kind of violence. You actually have to pause in the moment and say, that was not okay. That should not happen. And it should not happen again. And there's just still far too many people. Oh, I don't know out of a sense of they don't know what to say, so they say nothing, or they don't want to say the wrong thing, so they say nothing, or frankly, they're not sure anything was wrong with what happened, right? And they say nothing. But that silence is a powerful statement that really perpetuates a lot of the racism and violence that we see in the country.
I agree. I mean, silence, in my opinion, is complicity. And you know, you know, if we don't learn it from our history, we're doomed to repeat it. I mean, think about Germany, you know, during the Holocaust. How many people were quiet while their neighbors were just being taken away? And then, you know, next thing they're being taken away. You know, when does it end? So it's a very slippery slope. If someone doesn't stand up and kind of just nip that problem in the bud, it's just going to continue to grow and fester. And I understand where you're coming from, Gayatri. I mean, I've been in situations where, you know, we're just guys, we're just having fun, and somebody says something that's, you know, maybe not appropriate. And it can be as simple as saying, hey, dude, you know, that's not cool. You know, you don't have to make a big, you know, ordeal of it and embarrass them or put them on the spot. Just say, hey, you know, that's not cool. I've even had times where I pulled them aside afterwards and say, hey, like, you know, we don't call us Asians, not Oriental. Oriental is a rug or a vase. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know. You know, there's a lot of ways I feel like you can stop that quickly, really early on, before it develops into a problem.
I want to touch on two issues that Gayatri brought up, the hate crimes issue and then the idea of safety, and they're kind of entwined. Some of the debate right now about a piece of legislation that's being called a class protection bill, it's being presented sort of as an alternative or as some kind of a solution to the governor's call for passing a hate crimes legislation. Opponents of the bill have said it doesn't go far enough, you know, because one of the major issues is that it doesn't name specific groups who have been historically targeted in hate crimes. Supporters of the bill say that, you know, by keeping it broad, it applies to everyone. We don't want to leave people out. But if people who have historically been groups who've been historically the targets of hate crime, if they don't feel like it protects them or if they don't feel safe, does it really accomplish the goal of a hate crimes bill? And if the answer is no, what can be done to help make those people feel safe? Because it seems like that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that is, or maybe should be, one of the goals of a hate crimes law, is to deter such action, but also to make those people who have been targeted feel safer or feel like they have a sense of safety.
I don't think it does that. I don't think hate crimes legislation creates a sense of safety for people who have been discriminated against. I think what it does is it articulates that that's not the same as punching someone in the face. Punching someone in the face because you don't like them and you have a history with that. Now, violence is not okay, but punching someone in the face because you guys don't like each other is a very different crime and act and punching someone in the face because he or she is an Asian. Like the, those, and so I think what it does in a legal sense is it defines those two actions as different. And it defines the racially motivated or gender motivated crime as a different kind of crime, but because it is. But I don't actually think that increases safety. I think it increases the legal responsiveness to the egregiousness of the type of crime that it is. And to your question about hate crimes light, which is the other bill, I suppose you could say it's better than nothing. It gets us off the list of being one of three states in the nation that haven't passed hate crimes legislation. But I think it's a pretty unacceptable, sad version of the original bill. And, you know, I suppose I don't oppose it in the sense of, again, it's something, it's maybe better than nothing, one could argue, but it's not the same thing.
So if safety isn't necessarily the outcome, would you say that acknowledgement is? Maybe that's sort of the
the repercussions is probably a better way to put it, because historically, you know, a lot of Asian Americans have fought with the legal system for rights, and they use the law and the language in the law in order to gain rights. I mean, the 14th Amendment was tested by Asian Americans. And because of that language, we were able to be acknowledged as human beings. So I think that that's where the issue is, because safety isn't going to be guaranteed until racism is gone. Mm-hmm. Well, no bill is going to cure that. So, but when you have repercussions, when you have ramifications for having done something, that's when you have some teeth behind something. So if you know you're going to go to jail for doing this and you could lose your freedom, you know, that's when you have people pause and think, maybe this isn't the best idea, unfortunately, instead of, you know, this is a human being.
Yeah, I agree with both of those points. And also for me, because I'm a bit of a data nerd, but I think a real hate crimes bill that was, you know, maybe had a little bit more comprehensive language would really assist with tracking, because these aren't being tracked in our state. We really don't know how many crimes would be considered hate crimes. And my issue with the hate crime light and not specifically naming the classes makes me wonder, so is this gonna be cohesive with FBI data nationally? I mean, you know, if they're using these specific terminology and then us as a state are not, you know, it's some things that were kind of surprising to me when I read the bill. I mean, they don't talk about gender, they don't talk about sex, they don't talk about orientation, they don't talk about national origin, they don't talk about nationality, they don't mention military or veterans, which that was really shocking to me, because there are crimes against military and veterans. So I would like to just ensure, from a tracking point of view, is the language in our bill going to be in line with what's being reported by the FBI in the other 47 states that actually do have hate crimes bills? And because I was told, and this was surprising to me, that because Arkansas doesn't have a hate crimes bill, nothing gets reported to the FBI unless the victim calls the FBI specifically and says, hey, you know, by the way, this happened to me. So, I mean, how many people are going to file a police complaint and then also call the FBI, right? It's just another step they're going to do that they probably won't do. So I'm hoping maybe this bill is a jumping off point. Maybe over the course of the next year or two, as we are able to track these crimes in some way, we can realize that maybe it's not in line with the way the rest of the United States is tracking it and the FBI is tracking it. Maybe that can be a jumping off point to say we need to amend this to include those protected classes. I'm not sure, but I'm kind of with Guy Trey. Maybe it's better than nothing, but I would like to make sure that it was cohesive with what the FBI is doing for those tracking purposes.
Just on Josh's point about data, I think it's a really good one, because I think one of the ways in which structural racism and systemic racism is perpetuated is the lie that it doesn't exist. And it's very easy to say that wasn't that big a deal. It's very easy to say you took that too personally. It's very easy to say that, well, that's not what I meant and you know it. I'm a good person, I'm not racist. Those things are far too easy to push out as an excuse for behavior. And so I think data becomes a really relevant asset to all of our shared understanding of the reality of how discrimination shows up. And the Stop API Hate did a survey just very recently. And one of the questions they asked in the survey is, have you ever been asked, where are you from? comma, know where are you really from? Which, like, Susie's gonna laugh because we've all been asked that more times than we could begin to count. Well, what the survey showed was that over 60% of Asian Americans have been asked that question, and less than 10% of white people have been asked that question. And so I've actually not ever thought, like, I personally tell myself the story, the narrative of, oh, well, people are just curious about me and they're not trying to offend me. And they're like, okay, I've got this whole story in my head about how that's not a racially motivated or racist question. But I'll tell you what, it's an incredibly offensive question because it's not being asked of white people. And so what you're actually asking is, me and my white friends are clearly American. You and your Asian friends are clearly not. So tell me where it is you've, quote unquote, really come from, because obviously it's not America, right? There's this just, like, the embeddedness of the othering, of the sort of permanent status as a foreigner in the, is embedded in that question. And until I saw that data split on the 65%+ of Asians and less than 10% of, I was like, I never thought about it that way. And I got, like, 10 times more offended than I've ever been in the past by that question, which I get asked all the time, all the time.
Same. And, you know, I agree. That question is so, I mean, I think I thought it was a curiosity when I was younger and I just kind of played it off, but it is not appropriate. I mean, it delegitimizes you as an American. It's assuming you're, again, that perpetual foreigner. And if you're seen as that perpetual foreigner, you're not a, quote unquote, real American. So am I not afforded the rights of other Americans? And, you know, I read an article about how that always questioning where you're from, it also creates, not only does it disconnect you from America, but it's creating a tie between you and another country that maybe you don't even have ties to. So suddenly if China does something, because I can potentially, I'm my mom is Chinese Filipino, I'm told I look more Chinese. So because I look Chinese, am I now tied to what China's doing? How is that fair? You know, how many Americans are of British descent, or Irish, or French, or German? So if Germany does something, or Ireland does something, do we say, oh, you know what, you're a redhead and you're of Irish descent and I'm mad at you because we're, you know, the United States is disagreeing with Ireland right now on this? Of course not. Of course not. And again, people can't really tell. So it's just, you know, Asians are a monolith. So it doesn't matter if you're Vietnamese or Korean or Japanese. If we're mad at China, then you must be Chinese and we're mad at you too. So I really think that's such a dangerous statement. And it has opened my eyes as to how dangerous that statement is. You know, I think I played it off for so many years, and it's surprising what I've thought was okay or let people get away with. That's what's something that's woken me up a lot. I remember as a child, you know, going to the grocery store with my mom, and she had this long black hair down to the bottom of her back, and seeing strangers just start running their hands through her hair, just touching it. And they would say, oh, I'm sorry, your hair is so beautiful. I couldn't help myself. I had to touch it. And I thought at the time, oh, wow, you know, like, I've got such a pretty mom. They love her pretty hair. That's not okay. That is not okay for strange men and strange women to just come up to you and start touching your hair or touching your body. Or they would reach out and touch her arms and say, oh, I couldn't help myself. Your arms just look so smooth. I just had to touch them. Well, no, you don't have to touch my body. You don't know me, you know? And she would turn around and it was funny because she'd say, you know, no, it's not okay. You know, you don't, please give me my 3 feet of personal space. And then they would look at her like, oh, you're one of those. Like, somehow she's in the wrong for wanting to not be touched by a random stranger. Again, is her body just supposed to be a plaything for other people? I remember her being called China doll. You're just a cute little China doll. You're just a little China doll. And as a child, you think, oh, you know, they're complimenting my mom. That's not a compliment at all. So it's made me think about a lot of my past growing up in Arkansas and just things that were said to my mom, to myself, to my sister, and I don't know, revisiting it in a way and trying to understand it from an adult point of view.
I think it happens so often that it became normal for us, though, because if we want to really get to it, it wasn't something that's just happened once in a while. You know, all through my childhood, people would ask, are you Chinese or Japanese? And I'm like, neither. I guess I failed. You know, I don't know. And moving forward and back to the comment of, you know, where are you from? Where are you really from? That's happened so much that my answer is at this point that's inappropriate. And then they won't let it go. And they want to, well, what's the best way to say that then? Why do you need to know that? I mean, let's look at it logically. How is knowing that particular information, right, going to make your life any better, going to improve anything, whether it's our relationship, because that doesn't impact who I am right now in front of you, but it's something they can't let go of. I mean, well, what's the most appropriate way that I can ask? I don't want to be offensive. Well, then just don't ask. That's how you're not offensive, is you just let it go, because it really doesn't matter. If it's something, if it's a relationship, that stuff comes up organically. That's part of those conversations. That's how you get to know people, and you talk about your histories and where your parents are from and where your grandparents are from and all of these things. And it's a very organic process, but not a forced, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm in an FBI room with a lamp in front of my face, like, where are you from? You know, like, I don't need that. But it just feels as though it's things that people can't let go of. And I'm with both of them. I've done a lot of looking back and had to realize, oh, that was racist. They were being racist. And I feel very naive, because I'm like, I should have known that. But, you know, I've gone to Chinese buffets. I don't like to go there because I get stared at. I get asked, you know, random questions about how I made the dinner that I didn't make. I've had all kinds of stuff happen. And so you just start avoiding those awkward situations. You know, it's unfortunate, but they don't have to be that way. People just make these assumptions. And I might have a bit of a mouth and make smart ass comments back sometimes when it happens. And you know, say things like, I don't go to KFC and ask you what you cooked for dinner. So yeah, sometimes that's how you have to fix it too.
The clap back. I love it. So it's funny that you mentioned that, Susie, that incident in high school where my classmates asked me if my mother was a prostitute. I said, no, she's a registered nurse that was recruited this country because there was a lack of medical professionals in the state. What does your mother do for a living? They're like, oh, she's a housewife. I said, oh, so she doesn't work. Okay. You know, at the time, you know, I'm a teenager and I'm thinking, this is the way to kind of, how do you like it? You know, would you like to be asked that? It's a taste of your own medicine. And Susie, you're completely right. I mean, the stereotypes, I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've been asked if I'm the IT guy. You know, I'm always the IT guy, I guess. That it's sad that you do get used to that and you don't realize that it is a form of racism and it's a stereotype.
I think some of it, Susie, you touched on this, but it's like, What I want to say, and I don't always say, is, are you asking me that because you're curious about me? Or are you asking me that because I look different than the other three people sitting in the room, right? And so like, it's such an important question, because it's wonderful to be curious about different people's backgrounds. It's wonderful. But if there are four of us sitting together, three of us are white and one of us looks different like I do, and I'm the only one that you're asking about family background, just pause on that for a second. I don't want anyone to ever feel bad for being curious about the people around them, but I want people to think twice as to whether they're also curious about people who are, you know, tell me about your family background is an okay question to ask. I think for me, I am a lot more offended by where are you, quote unquote, you from, right? There's nuance in that. And so I don't want people to feel like they can't open their mouth and they can't engage with people and they can't be curious and they can't ask questions. But I think the question I would push folks to consider before you do is, would you ask anyone that question, or are you just asking me that question? Because that's where it starts to really be a reflection of that internalized bias and of that structural racism in terms of how we think about people within our community.
Oh, you're right. I had a conversation not too long ago, and it was a similar kind of virtual meeting like this. And we were asked, you know, what's a better way for someone to ask that? And I was with you, Susie. I was like, well, don't ask it. You just get to know me, like, be my friend. How about that? And we get to know each other. But if you have to make an assumption of where I'm from, why don't you assume that I'm an American and I'm from Arkansas? And then if I tell you differently, then you know.
Yeah.
Just assume that I'm an American just like you are.
I was born and raised in California. And so I just, when I would be asked that, where are you from? California. Where are you really from? California. And then I would just like stone cold silence. I know that's not what they're asking me. They're asking me to tell them that my father is of East Indian descent and he is from India, that my mother is from the United States, which is why my skin is lighter than most Indians. And that they like, and to tell them their whole love story and how did, could they possibly have met if they were from different countries? And how did you come to even exist? Like, who asks this of their white friends, right? So just pause, take a breath before you dive into that. But yeah,
I have a question for actually, if you don't mind, for Gayatri and Susie. Do you think there's
as long as it's not where you're from, Josh?
No, it's not where you're from. I know where you're from. Do you think it's like there's some kind of strange romanticization of, you know, you see Asian women, it's like the geisha, the love story that takes place during the war where the American soldier marries this Asian woman, or even on the darker note that Asian women are prostitutes or sex workers. I mean, but do you think there's this, I mean, there obviously is, but how do you think that plays into that whole idea of the relationships? Like what I was asked or what maybe you're asked. I mean, I even had, you know, my sister said that men just come up to her and tell them about, well, you know, older men, she's a doctor. So when she's treating them, they'll say, oh, well, you know, I had a fling back in, you know, Vietnam back in the day. And she's like, why? Okay. Like, why do I need to know this? You know, just, but how do you as Asian women feel about that? It's not romantic. So I don't want to say romanticization, but you know, that stereotype, that fetish of Asian women or geishas, or, you know, we've got some war story about it.
A lot of ways. It's dangerous for one. I can't tell you the worst pickup lines, but one of my favorite worst ones is I've never been with an Asian. And then I respond with, well, you're not about to be. Because that's just terrible. But there's this mentality of, you know, sexualization. And it's not just from men. I've had women, especially, you know, those of Caucasian descent that I don't know if it's racial. I've had so many inner dialogues over the past year that I'm just like, I feel like I'm having an existential moment where I'm trying to reevaluate my entire life. But you know, a lot of women have come up to me after they've gotten to know me and said, you know, I didn't think I was going to like you at first because you're so intimidating. And I'm thinking, what's intimidating about me? If you just met me, there's only a few things, you know, is it because I'm an Asian woman? Then there's this sense of, you know, of gender kind of, you know, warfare or something. I don't want
maybe
your
they
man.
Think you know martial arts and you're gonna
I do I like I'm not I don't like you do but I have gotten to the point where I'm just gonna fall into all the categories. I do need access to your computer. I can kick your butt. All of those things. I feel like there's a lot of information on their computers that we could use. Anyways, yeah, so you know, my dad was white and very much military and went to Korea and met a Korean woman and brought her back. I mean, it's the standard story that we all kind of laugh about because it happens so often. But that was also really heavily played up because the war brides was a thing, you know, they really incentivized it. And so I think that it's part of that normalization where we all kind of laugh, and I don't know about you guys, but I know a lot of people are like, oh, same story. Different dad, but sometimes, you know, I think that plays into it. But then when it comes to relationships, there's definitely this sense of ownership that happens. And as I don't know if it's the same with other women as it is with my experience. I have dated men where I had to make sure that they didn't only date Asian women because it's very unhealthy and lots of very unhealthy things come from that. They have very unhealthy expectations. And you know, it's one thing to date and or want the idea of dating an Asian woman. It's very different to actually date one because I love kimchi and you're probably not going to like it. So we can't hang out. You know, it's just, it's more than just that superficiality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, I think I reflect a lot about just, I think it's, to me, it's about intersectionality and it's about interracial marriage. So, you know, Susie and I both are I actually was called Hapa a lot in high school, which is really funny because I'm Indian, but okay, cool. Take it. I was actually really excited because I was like, oh my God, there's a word for what I am, because, you know, I got a lot of like, well, are you Indian or are you American? Because clearly you cannot be both at the same time. And even if I had come from another country and I lived here now, I could still be American, right? So I think that genuinely human desire to place folks in categories and to understand them through that categorization is a natural, normal thing for the brain to do. And I think that we are only in sort of several generations worth of interracial marriage and of kids who are biracial existing. And I think even the classifications, you know, through all of this with Black Lives Matter and focus on Asian hate, I have a lot of friends who are Black and Asian. And this has created for them a lot, just a lot to think through and to process, including the world recognizing you can actually be both Black and Asian, that one is not mutually exclusive of the other. And I think for the most part, we're just like not there yet in terms of understanding that those classifications are false, the very sort of nature of race as a social construct. And therefore, as you see more and more marriage and relationship and reproduction of kids across those different backgrounds, to see a lot more people that look ambiguously brown like I do, which like I had a friend in high school who coined that. Well, she would use that term when people would say, where are you from? And she'd say, why are you asking? Because I'm ambiguously brown, which is to say like not quite white, but also not quite dark enough to be Black, right? And because we had mostly African-Americans and Caucasians in our high school, there were very few people that fell in any other category. But I think all of that is a reflection of seeking a sense of belonging. And all of that, all of those questions, all of that, what are you, where do you come from, who are you, who's your dad, who's your mom, is a sense of trying to fit you into those sort of known and trusted classifications. And I think stepping back from that and saying, it's actually okay if I don't know your entire family tree in order to sit through this business meeting with you, or it's okay, right? Like if I don't have that information, I can still get to know you as a person without it. And that's how we get to a place of you feeling a sense of belonging in it at work or in your community, is not having the first question that comes at you be about your background.
I mean, I've thought maybe I should just take my 23andMe results and print it on a t-shirt and just like wear it around. You know, maybe that's the answer. you know, one other thing that I've with all this has come up, the Asian hate, I've thought about how my sister and I were raised and how just having conversation with friends and colleagues, how differently we were raised compared to just your average Arkansan or average American. I remember, you know, my dad and my mom having to build us up as kids before we even started kindergarten, saying, hey, FYI, you're going to be picked on. You look different. I need you to speak perfect English, have no accent. I need you to carry yourself well. I need you to be proper. I need you to speak better, dress better. Have better posture than all the other kids, so then they don't have anything to pick on you for because they're already going to think you're less than. And I mean, I remember being told that at age four or five years old before I started kindergarten, and almost like sending little kids out to battle or something, you know, and I thought that, I honestly thought that was normal. I thought that was normal. I thought that's what everyone did to their kids, and it's not normal. So that's been kind of a wake up call. Just now I'm reanalyzing everything that happened to me growing up. And, you know, wow, there was a lot of things that are just a little outside the box, but that's, I thought that was normal, but that was either a way for my parents to try to protect me or empower me. And then of course there were things that happened externally that I played off and I realized, you know, were not appropriate. And my sister always said, she's like, if I get called exotic one more time, like I'm going to just run for the hills. You know, if a man tries to date you and they say, you're so exotic, she's like, nope, bye.
Josh, your point about language is such an interesting one. My dad spoke 7 languages and I speak 1, which I find to be incredibly embarrassing for me, not for him. And that was intentional on his part for the exact reason you're stating. And my observation, and this is a generalization, but my observation right now for friends who are having kids and speak multiple languages is that they've really with intention preserved those languages for their kids, which is very different from how I was raised. And, you know, I like to think that might be a bright spot of hope for our future, but it is really, it's a sad thing for me because it means that I'm not able to communicate with my Indian family in their native language. And what that meant is I never was able to speak to my own grandmother because we didn't share a language. For me, there's a deep sadness in that, that my dad didn't feel enough sense of faith and confidence in how he and I would be treated in this country to share that part of his culture with me. And I think, you know, but I really hadn't thought about that much until much more recently. And like, why was that? What caused that? How was he feeling when he made that choice? Right. And I think part of that's because we just don't talk about these things. It's just sort of like, oh, well, that's, you know.
It seems like that was an effort on his part to protect you.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I've seen, and I had this happen where I have a Korean name, but I was very, very pushed to my American name. And many of my friends who are half Asian are the same. And so we've been detached from that. And I'm seeing right now what's been really, I guess, I don't know if refreshing is the right way to say it, but just revitalizing is seeing a lot of us reclaim those names and say, I've even seen many more of my friends who are trying to actively learn their languages, because I think that was really common. My mother she just wanted to fit in. She didn't want to be any different. And I think that there was this mentality that we have to be as white as we can. And that means language and dress and everything else so that we can be accepted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm envious of the seven languages myself, and I speak several very poorly. I know several really good words that I can't say on here, but other than that, you know, I'm with you though. And it's very hard to be a Hapa because I don't know that our stories have been well explained, because I don't know about either of you guys, but you don't really fit in on either side necessarily. Uh-oh. Because you have access to this other side, and there's this resentment, but also this curiosity on both sides of what that is. And I have a community where they say that we're the bridge to the future. Uh-huh. Because we have this way of seeing into both worlds that no other world can do. And I think that that's why it's so important for us to have these types of conversations, because if we're not being heard, if we're not allowed the space to speak, how do we grow and evolve? And without evolution, without growth, you know, everything dies. So it's progress or perish.
Susie, it's funny that you talk about the, you know, being a Hapa and not kind of fitting in, but like when everything was happening with the increased hate crimes against Asian Americans, one of my mom's sisters sent me a text, and she said, well, you and your sister will be safe because you're white passing. And I said, huh? I said, have you seen me? And I live in Arkansas, like totally not white passing at all. If you really think that, then yeah, I'm like, do I need to buy Auntie some glasses for her birthday? But it's, again, perception is reality. And it just shows to me that race is a social construct, because what, you know, it's unfortunate, but we tend to look at the features that are different than our own instead of looking at the similarities. You know, I told my auntie, I said, Auntie, I have slanted eyes and black straight hair. Like, I totally am Asian, you know. But to your point, Susie, I mean, I chose to reclaim my mother's maiden name several years ago, because my legal name is Joshua Allen Ong Price, and Ong is my mother's maiden name. And in Philippine culture, your mother's maiden name is your middle name. And they kind of, my parents kind of incorporated both. They gave me, you know, a traditional Western middle name, but also snuck my mom's middle name in there too, or maiden name. So for, you know, a long time, it's just Joshua A. Price. What does the A stand for? It could be Allen or Ong. So I've really tried to reclaim the Ong and be proud of it, and be proud of my Asianness, because at the end of the day, I look like this, and I'm not going to try to play it off and pretend I'm something I'm not.
Well, I really appreciate your insight as you've reflected back on some moments in your life. But as we wrap up this conversation, I want to look forward for a moment. When tragedies like this happen, with the shooting in Atlanta or the incident in Hot Springs, a spotlight gets put on that certain community. And one of the things I kept hearing you guys say over and over again is, you know, people don't know, they aren't paying attention. Now that they are, at least in this moment, what can be done here to take advantage of the fact that, you know, people are paying attention, some people are listening, you know, where can we go from here? How do we move forward in a better manner?
I can start. It's going to sound a tiny bit counter to the conversation we were just having about asking where someone's from, but I actually think it's important to just dive into what feels like the contradiction there, which is I think the best thing any one individual can do is to be curious about the people around them. But I think to manage that curiosity in a way that's appropriate and comfortable to everybody else, right? So here in Bentonville, for example, we do have a large South Indian population. We have a number of events, we have festivals, and they're open to everybody. And very rarely do folks from outside the community come, but they're always welcome. And, you know, I said to someone who I mentioned an event that was happening and they're like, oh, well, you know, I'd feel so uncomfortable. I'd be the only white person there. And then you have to like pause and be like, ah, yes, like every day of my life. Right. So like just that recognition that it's okay to feel uncomfortable and do it anyway. So I think that's the one piece of advice I would give.
Yeah, I'll piggyback off that. I mean, you know, if you don't have any Asian friends, make an Asian friend. If you have one that you work with or you see on a regular basis, take, you know, go to lunch, have a coffee, get to know one another, patronize your Asian businesses. And as Susie said, you know, sometimes us Hapas have to be the bridge. So, you know, I mean, I've invited several friends to go eat Indian food for the first time or Japanese food for the first time. And they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to eat that. And then they end up really enjoying it. And it's something they continue to do. So I agree, having that curiosity, you know, in a friendly way, a friendly curiosity. And I would also say maybe something that's a little bit more action oriented to the recent, you know, rash of hate crimes. There's a website, it's called iHollaBack, iHollaBack.org. And they have harassment intervention training. So if you do see any kind of instance of hate or crime that's being committed against someone of Asian descent, it gives you some resources and some skills on how to handle that situation and how to report it to the right authorities and also report it online so they could track that and then how to comfort the victim. So again, if you see something, say something and call it out.
I'm so glad you mentioned an actual, like a resource that people could go to. I really like their bystander training. That's a really good one. And I mean, there's really five ways to intervene. And what's great about it is the fact that it's based on what you're comfortable with. I think too often we say, well, you need to step in. Not every situation calls for that. And not every person is capable of that. So there's lots of different, you know, strategies or techniques that people can do, you know, knowing who they can call, knowing how to distract. A great example that I've heard once was, you know, if someone's arguing in a restaurant, tell the server that it's their birthday and have them send cake over, because who doesn't love cake? And it'll, you know, fix everything. So that's a silly example. But I also think to Gayatri's point earlier, as far as curiosity, I think that something that should be actionable isn't is, where are we in history? Where are we in US history? Why are there no Asian Americans that are taught in school? My daughter is going into ninth grade and I asked her, have you learned anything? Has anything changed in the time that I've gone to school? No, nothing. When I went to Barnes and Noble in Little Rock the other day, I went to look at the US history section. We aren't there, we aren't included. And yet we are vital to our history. We have done historical things, not only for Asian Americans, but for America, period. So I think that we need to push for education to be more inclusive, especially history, not just for Asian Americans, but for all of us, because we are all a part of this country. And until we start to recognize and learn that, no one will ever see it any differently.
Thank you all so very much for taking the time to share your stories and your insight. We really, really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having us. It was a good conversation. You.
Our guests today were activist Susie Reese, Joshua Ong Price, president of the AAPI Caucus, and Bentonville Councilwoman Gayatri Agnew. Thank you all again for sharing your time and stories with us. Well, that's it for today's episode. But don't forget, you can listen to past editions of our podcast at argotsoul.com/affirmativeaction. You can also subscribe and rate our show on Apple Podcasts. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next month with an all-new episode. But until then, take care.